This is the Dallas Morning News.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello, everybody. Welcome into Sports Day Insider, presented by the Dallas Morning News. I am Kevin Sherrington, joined by my old pals Evan Grant and David Moore. Evan's out of spring training. Evan, what's it like out there in Surprise?
Well, we are today in the flight pattern from Luke Air Force Base, so it's like a Super Bowl flyover every 15 minutes. It's great. That was what I was most excited about yesterday was, or the Sunday was, seeing the flyover before the game. Not the Taylor Swift stuff. You know, I don't care one way or another, but I wanted to see the flyover. So here we get them every 10 minutes. It's great. You'll probably hear a few while we're recording this.
Is anybody out in the street singing the national anthem?
Nobody is out singing the national anthem at this point.
No. Okay. Well, you might try that yourself. That might get all the neighbors going.
No.
No, that's it. And David is back from the Super Bowl. Speaking of which, David, you have a good time out there?
I am back. I wouldn't say a good time. I think it's a little different for the media. You know, with the schedule and going back and forth, and it's certainly a jam-packed week. But I would say it was a productive week. And yeah, I mean, you know, look, it's the Super Bowl is, you know, absurd and over the top every year. And is there a better host city for absurd and over the top than Vegas? And I'm sure it will return. It was a good logistical setup, really, I think, for the Super Bowl. And I would be shocked if it's not part of the rotation going forward.
What's that stadium like? Obviously, I've never been in it.
You know, that was the only stadium I had not been in. And I really liked it. The thing I liked about it is also one of the things I like about the stadium in Minneapolis is, one, I think it's visually attractive, and aesthetically inside, there are a lot of nice touches. Just from watching the game in the press box is like it is in Minneapolis. It is open. So you get the crowd noise and feel, and you're a little bit more connected to the game. And you know, look, for a media experience in the game, I understand that's very low on the list. Where, you know, it's about the fan experience and the suite owners and all of that. But I really enjoy being able to be at a game and feel I'm actually in the environment, as far as hermetically sealed off like you are in most stadiums.
Yeah, just as long as it doesn't impact your equipment.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Remember back in the old days with the porta bubbles?
Porta bubbles.
Every once in a while, you'd have to put stuff down in the couplers to keep the sound noise from getting in there and have it reacting to that.
Or you'll have to jam this thing they used to call a landline into the couplers and hold it in to make sure it didn't disrupt during sending.
I'll tell you, there's nothing, you know, some people would say, like, hey, let's talk about Usher and Ludacris, and that might bring in the young listeners. But no, we have the secret sauce. Let's talk about print newspaper outdated technology.
Evan, that draws them in.
Every once in a while, it's just okay to throw something back, you know?
No, the past does not matter.
You are not hip. No, nothing you're going to do is ever going to make you hip. Okay.
You think people are going to listen to this podcast to hear you talk about Ludacris?
Let me just say this.
That is Ludacris.
I'm not worried about being hip. I'm just worried about being hipper than the two of you. That's all that I have to accomplish here.
It's like that old bag joke.
It's like you don't have to be the fastest zebra. You just don't want to be the slowest one, because that's the one that the lion catches.
Yeah. Yeah, like I know this, Evan. I can run laps around you, so I'm not worried about that.
So now you're quoting Red Bull commercials.
You're an old man.
Evan, I was out there at the Y today, buddy. getting on the old treadmill, back in form, getting in, back in shape. Woo!
For what? What are you getting in shape for?
Trying to stay that alive. That's what I'm trying to do.
Why do you need to be in shape?
Boy, that is so ugly, you guys. You know, most people would say, Kevin, that is so great that you're getting out there and staying in shape, trying to stay alive, trying to stay a functioning member of your family and of this newspaper. And instead, you guys are going, what are you trying to do that for? Why don't you just die and rot, you old man?
Well, that may have been a bit beyond what we were saying.
They could embalm you.
I've already been embalmed. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about that Super Bowl. So it was the biggest, most watched television event ever, right? Or since the Apollo landing? Is that it?
Since the moon landing. And are we really sure there was a moon landing, Kevin?
Yeah, that's right. You watched that, I guess. Didn't they make a movie about that? Oh, my gosh. That's really something that, and you know, people, let me ask you this. How much of it do you think it is just the fact that, well, it's the Super Bowl and football is America's favorite sport and all of that? How much of it is that? And how much of it is the fact that Usher is going to be at the halftime and you got a superstar country, or not country, superstar singer in the press box or in the suites? I mean, how much of it is all of that put together?
Well, that's your peripheral audience, you know, that builds around the core audience. And that's really the only way you can expand these events this year. I mean, you get people watching and are interested, and there are different entry points to get those numbers up. You can't really grow your football audience anymore. So the Super Bowl is about, some people turn on and just to watch the commercials and
sure,
the game is background noise. Some turn on to see the halftime performance. And when you have these other things swirling around, the Taylor Swift effect and others, it just builds. And I'm still amazed, beyond this, I believe from what I saw that the top rated broadcast shows of 2023, I believe 95 or 96 of the top 100 were NFL games.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to credit it all. I mean, the lion's share of it, really, to the Taylor Swift effect. Because like David said, football fans are going to watch the game. You're not going to lose out on any football fans. Maybe the halftime show moves the needle a little bit one way or another from year to year. But I would tell you that, you know, the last 5 years or so, I think the Super Bowl's been on a really good run in terms of halftime artists who are going to connect with a younger audience. I just think that the Taylor Swift effect was a huge element this year. And it's the NFL's gain. The NFL wins on that. But, yeah, I think that she, her presence – brought a whole dimension of people to the game that wouldn't necessarily watch it. Your reactions.
Yeah. Well, you see people talking about how their young daughters wanted to watch the game for the first time just to see her. And all of this, again, this is one of the silliest outcries of in a society that demands an outcry every day over something. But all of this, well, they show her too much. She dominates the broadcast, all this, all that. I saw, I believe the total amount of airtime she had in the game was 52 seconds, which accounted for right at or a little less than 1% of the total broadcast time.
David, that is an out and out lie. It was 54 seconds.
I'm sorry.
I saw.
Yeah. Look, it's the same thing. It's the same thing as when Jerry Jones is in the box. How many times do they show Jerry Jones? You know, who cares? I don't care who they're showing. It doesn't make any difference to me. Half the time I just don't pay attention to that. But to your point about the expanding the audience here, in our family, in the Super Bowl party we had at our house, the women were all excited about seeing Taylor Swift and about Usher, and that was those were the two main reasons they were watching it. And I just think that basically people with the Super Bowl, it's just an excuse to have a party. You know, that's the thing about football. No other sport in America, anyway, has a one-game championship. You know, basically. I mean, you do have playoffs, but there's not a series involved here. Where I think that in some ways, I realize that in a seven game series, they do better if you get towards that end. The ratings are always better at that. But I also feel like there has to be a little bit of a deadening effect to people there in our society now. We just want one thing to wrap it up. We like to point towards one game right here at the end of the week. Here we go. This is the game we know we're going to see. We're all planning for it. Here it is. We saw it. That's it. It's over.
Do it. Check the box and move on to whatever is next. Entertainment, political, whatever it is that you want to be outraged by or entertained by. Just go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Correct. Absolutely. And I do think we need to revisit one thing here. Where the hell was my invitation?
No invitation. This was just—it was a closed circle on this one. Just family. We didn't even have the whole family, and it was still a full house. All right. Now let me—you left family members
out of your party. You wouldn't let them into your family. No,
there were people outside knocking, and we would not let them in. Get out of here! I just went on the ring and said, "Get out! Go back!" I didn't even open the door. All right.
First aid family members.
So, David, I don't remember. Who did you pick in the Super Bowl?
Oh, well, I believe I said I don't see how anyone could pick against Patrick Mahomes, but sure, I would. I would go San Francisco.
That's right, David. And once again, you were proven wrong. Boy, and David, then, you can't pick Brock Purdy over Patrick Mahomes, can you? Boy, I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable.
Well, you can't pick any quarterback over Mahomes right now, and that's the point. And it's we saw a generational talent and achievement in Tom Brady and went, wow, this is going to be pretty hard to duplicate. And now Patrick Mahomes coming right after him is on the same pace. They both have three titles in their first seven seasons in the league. Now, the interesting part is Brady then had a 10-year gap before he got his next four. All four of those came after the age of 35. You know, health and a lot of things, that's a lot to take into account to say that, he's certainly going to have the same longevity that Tom Brady did. But Mahomes has positioned himself, and if they can do something here, if he can pick up a couple of more in the next 4 to 5 years, it's going to be pretty interesting as far as this chase of Tom Brady. As it is, he already passed Roger Staubach in Super Bowl titles on Sunday, and he equaled Troy Aikman. So Troy Aikman and Patrick Mahomes are currently tied for the fourth most Super Bowl titles by any quarterback, and he's only 28.
Evan, was there something you wanted to say?
Well, there's a flyover currently going on over here. But I will use that as my cue to just, again, say I can't think of a football player, of an NFL player, that I have enjoyed or made appointment TV to watch more than Patrick Mahomes. The last player I felt this way about was watching Deion at the, really at the prime of his career play that position. Patrick Mahomes is just such a joy to watch, and you know that he's going to do something. I don't want to say historic in terms of performance, but you know he's going to do something to win the game. And the minute that they got the ball, it was over with. You knew that they were going to win that game.
Everybody, right? Everybody said that's going to happen. And this was, he's been in four Super Bowls. He's trailed by 10 or more points in all four, and he has a 3-1 record.
Yeah, everybody did that except for Kyle Shanahan. That was the one guy who didn't think that maybe that was a good idea to let him have four shots at getting whatever he needed to get. Do we think that was a mistake? Obviously, or let me just. I guess I should ask that question. Should Kyle Shanahan have said, "Yeah, we will receive here on the first overtime"?
I understand the point you're talking about. Whereas, if you score on the first possession, which is what San Francisco did, and then turned it over, you're not giving Patrick Mahomes three downs to pick up a first. You're giving him four. which is what we saw early there, right? They picked up a fourth and one. And then,
right.
Whereas if San Francisco hadn't scored, or if Kansas City would have gotten the ball first and been in that situation, would they have gone for it on fourth and one there? No way in the world, because, you know, if they didn't convert it, San Francisco's right. already in position for a field goal. So right. from that standpoint, the way it unfolded, you could say yes. But I think there's – look, I thought San Francisco's defense was playing well. And would you rather have Purdy jumping out and playing from a lead or playing from behind? So, you know, we say all this. You give the ball to Kansas City, they score a touchdown. How much pressure is that on Purdy? Who hadn't been in the league and is not as good as Mahomes. So I did not have the problem with it that a lot of people have. I think it's a very good point to debate, but I don't know that we've seen enough analytics on it to say which way you should go. And then I did see an interesting poll. Someone kind of polled randomly, just analytics people around the league, and it was split.
Really?
It was split on people saying, well, no, you take the first shot at it. Because that changes the dynamic of the game. Others saying no. Then others making it specific. Well, no, if you have Mahomes, you don't put him in that position. But I didn't have a problem. I didn't have a problem with it. Look, Kansas City came on in the second half, and in my mind, San Francisco actually lost that game early when they went into halftime with only a 10-3 lead. The way they had dominated on both sides of the ball, I think if they would have pushed it up to 17 or 20-3, which is basically the way they performed, and it could have been, then I don't see Kansas City coming back. But I think San Francisco really lost it in the first half.
100% on that. I thought at halftime the Chiefs are going to win this game because they trail by only a touchdown.
10-3, and that's just one magical moment from Mahomes. That's all you need. One moment, one play, and then, you know, people will say it would be that botched punt return, but I would argue that is what makes Patrick Mahomes different. Other quarterbacks would have scored, led their team to score there too. Mahomes did it on the very first play, and that's what these special players do, because that is even more demoralizing once a team makes a mistake one play later to find a score given up. I think that hits a team harder than a 4 or 5 play drive would have to go in and score there.
One quick thing here, because we need to talk about the Cowboys before we get out of this football segment of the podcast.
Why do we need to talk about the Cowboys? Why?
Cowboys? Be quiet. We're going to talk about the Cowboys. Golly, be quiet. One of the things about that, too, is I thought Tony – a shout-out to Tony Romo, because on the play where they forced the incompletion, Tony said, you know that Steve Spagnuolo is going to dial up a blitz here and that you have to account for that. And the 49ers did not account for that. Left a guy wide open, running right into Brock Purdy's face. I will say, I know that Purdy has his critics, and I think some of that's – probably rightfully so. He got his team to the Super Bowl. But in that particular play, I would like to see him, instead of making a panic throw, just take a step. Like, fake one way, go the other way. That guy's running at you full blast. Try to avoid that guy and then make a throw. That's the only thing I would say about Brock Purdy in that situation. But it was not a situation where they accounted for it. You know, they did not either expect the blitz, or he didn't call up something. He didn't audible anything to get out of that play and give him a chance to make a play. And I would also say, you got to get that ball to McCaffrey more often there at the end. They were doing that on their previous drive and having a lot of success with it. He was just gashing the Chiefs defense at that point. And I thought that's why they were going to win. And they didn't do that. So, all right, let's talk about the what's happening here with the Cowboys. They did indeed hire Mike Zimmer as the defensive coordinator after some little intrigue there over the weekend with Rex Ryan saying, oh, wait a minute, not so fast. I think maybe I'm going to be the next defensive coordinator of the Cowboys. David, you kind of put that all to rest and said that was the Cowboys' intention all along to hire Mike Zimmer, but maybe they were part of the intrigue at that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's and from the people I talked to, they were blown away by Rex Ryan's interview. They were very impressed by him. He won the room, won the interview, if you will. And to me, that's not surprising. He's a very, you know, bold, engaging guy, and he's been a head coach in this league at two stops, was a good defensive coordinator before that. So that's not surprising. But starting last Thursday, when they began negotiations with Mike Zimmer, they didn't look back. Mike Zimmer was their choice. And the whole idea that they were waffling this weekend, I have not found anything to that whatsoever. Once the decision was made, they went through to get the contract done with Mike Zimmer. It took them a little more time than both sides thought to get it right, where they were both comfortable with it. Now, so from that perspective, did the Cowboys mind? And if you listen to what Ryan said on NFL Countdown on Sunday, he said, well, my understanding is Zimmer doesn't have the job yet. It hasn't, which was true. But that didn't mean he didn't have the job because they were going to give it to Rex Ryan. It just meant that they hadn't worked it out yet. Now, if you want to take this farther, if they had been unable to reach an agreement yesterday, then does Rex Ryan come back in? No question. But I think I took what Rex Ryan said Sunday as the final public lobbying attempt of a candidate to keep his name alive and say, hey, look, I've noticed you guys aren't done yet. I still really want this. This is why I want it. But in him saying that, which I took as just strictly a lobbying attempt for him for the job, others interpreted as, oh, what's going on here? Well, Zimmer isn't hired yet. So what is something going on here? Are they looking at him? Are they indecisive? Are they undecided on how to go? But my understanding was once they decided on Mike Zimmer on Thursday, they didn't waver.
I think the upshot of all this is that Rex Ryan will be the Cowboys' next head coach.
Well,
he won the room. It's going to be sitting in Jerry's mind all year.
Yeah. And you can't lose your value that way, right? Sometimes it's better not to get a certain job, but to leave the impression of, wow, I really like that guy. We have to put him in the mix going forward. So, yeah, it's The Cowboys landed on the defensive coordinator that made the most sense for where this team is and for who this head coach is, Mike McCarthy, who is going into a fifth year of a contract with no assurance that it's going to be extended or he'll be back.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting to go back and to see just what Rex Ryan has said about Mike McCarthy and Dak Prescott, for that matter, over the last few years. I seem to recall Rex was a little critical of Dak. Might be a little hard to bring that guy aboard when you can so easily document some of these things that they've come out and said. Rex and his brother and his dad were never too shy about speaking their minds. And sometimes that can kind of come back to bite you a little bit.
Kevin, let's face facts. If Rex Ryan was the Cowboys head coach and he comes up to the podium and finishes something up with, let's get some snacks, number one, I'll be out there to go have snacks, and you'll be out there lapping up those kinds of quotes. So let's all hope that this takes place.
Well, yeah, you can't ever tell. It'll be interesting to me to see if, you know, going to this, the lame duck year of Mike McCarthy as a head coach, as we know, Jerry likes to put his people in these kinds of situations. He thinks they perform better under pressure like this. I'm sure they wouldn't agree with that, but we'll see what he does the next time. Will he try to go back for another what he considers a proven head coach like a Rex Ryan, like a Bill Belichick, or would he go for somebody young and unproven the next time? I got before we get out here of the Cowboys segment, I'm going to ask both of you guys that if this is the last year as Mike McCarthy's coach, would Jerry try to hire a proven head coach like one of the guys we just talked about, or would he go out on a limb and try to do a Jason Garrett thing all over again? David?
You want to go ahead and fire Mike McCarthy?
No, I'm trying to fire him right now.
January?
Yeah exactly.
It's never too soon. Three consecutive seasons.
It's never too soon to get on with that kind of thing.
For the first time in 28 years, a team has gone Cowboys.
Emmitt Smith says he should have been fired. That's the NFL's all-time leading rusher, pal. Okay.
Okay. then I think Emmett should be the coach.
Yeah, that's there you go. I'm all for that. No, seriously, it just if you were gonna guess, I'm gonna say that I'll go first. I'll say I think that Jerry would always at this point in his life. He's going to hire a proven coach. He's going to hire a guy he thinks is going to do. He is not going to try to guess on anybody at this point. So
he just had Jason Garrett for 9+ years and invested him in the unproven coach at the age of 82, which Jerry will be in October. He's not going to go out and do an out of the box hire.
Yeah, I don't think so. Evan.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing for me is I don't know how many – Belichick's going to be, what, 73 next year? I don't know. I guess my point is I don't know how many really proven asset head coaches there may be out there. I suppose if Mike Vrabel doesn't take a job between now and then, that's a guy that I'd have some interest in because I think he does kind of bring some level of that kind of young – dynamic feel, but also look, he's got the chops of having been a head coach and the coaching tree that he comes from. So that's one guy that would interest me. Other than that, listen, I'm not huge on, for lack of a better term, retreads at this point. I think that, you know, there needs to be some new energy. You know, I'm a big Mike McDaniel type of guy, and I'd like to see an inspired hire like that.
But yeah, that's the deal. Do you trust Jerry Jones to make an inspired hire? When was the last inspired hire Jerry made as a head coach? Well, it was Jimmy Johnson. That was it. That was his one big inspiration was Jimmy Johnson. Everybody else after that, I mean, you could say that Barry Switzer, you know, and he did win a Super Bowl with Barry. So that's, I guess maybe I'm going to give him that one. A lot of people would say, you're crazy. We're not giving Barry Switzer any.
Barry's about as out of the box as you can get, though.
Well, he is. He is that. And I got to tell you, it's like my conversation with Frank Luxa one time. We were talking about how everybody was criticizing Barry as a head coach, didn't know what he's doing. And Barry and Frank said, I don't care if he knows what he's doing or not. He's interesting. That's all I care about. And I said, I'm with you, pal. Put me down with that. Interesting. I'm always for that.
That's why you want Rex Ryan and his let's go get some snacks, boys.
Well, that would probably be all right, especially if he has a good walk-off. I'm always interested in a good walk-off with a head coach, you know? You want these guys that, you know, although Bill Parcells did not have walk-offs, but his press conferences were so good, we didn't care. Right, David?
Yeah, they weren't really about the topic or the team, but he went on Football 101 and he knew how to give you something to write and keep you away from addressing anything specific about the team at that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Bum Phillips was good at that too. Bum would say something really funny and you'd ask him a direct question and he'd say something really funny. If you persisted in that direct question, it was like, oh, and he's not so funny after that. He didn't like it. He felt like if he's making you laugh, that should have been good enough, which, you know, looking back on it, yeah, it was good enough, actually.
I will say this, you know, if we're talking about colorful guys, Jerry Glanville is back as a defensive coordinator at 82 years old at, like, Northwestern Oklahoma State. So maybe he's there. He could leave some tickets for Elvis. It would be all fun and games again.
Oh, it'd be great. I hope that he knows where he's going when he's up there and he's driving around and northeast, northwest, whatever directional school it is up there in Oklahoma. Those are always great. All right, that's going to do it for our Cowboys/Super Bowl segment of the podcast. We're going to move over and talk about the Rangers now. Evan's up there in Surprise, Arizona, spring training tomorrow, Wednesday. We're taping this on Tuesday. Is pitchers and catchers report? Those are sacred words to all those seam heads out there. Evan, as far as you know, everybody's supposed to be there. No one's holding out. Nobody's going to be a no-show.
This ain't the NFL, Kevin. I've had one holdout in 30-plus years of covering baseball, and I was told when I was – at that point in time, it was a guy with the Marlins who's departed our planet named Chuck Carr. But he had no leverage. He held out with no leverage. So wasn't exactly the smartest strategy on the planet. The biggest question always is whether anybody will come in here would be delayed by any kind of travel issues or anything. I was out there today, and there were a number of position players and a number of pitchers getting work in. This is a team that is the defending world champions. They want to be back together, and they want to prove that last year wasn't just a fluke. So I think that everybody's going to be here and be fired up. I suppose it does lead into the one question that we could talk about, and that is, you know, what would Adolis Garcia's state of mind be going into this? And I know you weren't crazy about how the Rangers treated him during the arbitration process.
No, I wasn't. You know, and I realized that listen, I'm not a management guy, and I'm always the rank and file, you know, the little man. That's me. Even though I'm making a case for the big man, Adolis Garcia. And that is this. Look, I realize that and as you reported, his numbers were very similar to Kyle Tucker's arbitration case. And Kyle Tucker ended up getting $5 million, which is what the Rangers were negotiating with him. Although Kyle Tucker is what, 25?
He's 4 years younger than Garcia. He was 26 going into arbitration.
Okay. 26, that's 4 years younger. So he's got a lot of time to make up the money that Adolis is not going to have. So that's one thing. Number two, Adolis, you know, running away is the heart and soul of that Rangers club. Even the best player on that club said so. And he's batting cleanup on a World Series team, at least as long as he was able to in the World Series. And they wouldn't have got to the World Series without him, without his performance in the ALCS. He's got two guys hitting in front of him and make more than 1 week than he made all year long last year. So to me, those are issues. And then to take it one step further, we know Adolis is a really emotional guy, right? And he wears his heart on his sleeve. And I would think the last thing you want to do was to risk anything with him. Now, I know that a lot of this was his representation, and maybe that wasn't the best, and maybe they didn't do a good job. I just feel like if I would have asked Adolis, what do you feel like is a fair number here? Obviously, they were asking for $6 million, right?
Well, I mean, the number they submitted was seven.
Seven. All right, so they're asking for $7 million. I would have said, oh, Adolis, you want $7 million a year for 2 years. I tell you what, we're going to give you $14 million, or we're going to give you $28 million. We're going to double what you were asking for. And if in subsequent, you know, negotiations, people come up and say, hey, this is what you gave Adolis Garcia, this is what we're going to want, I would tell them, well, when you're the ALCS MVP and you're going to back cleanup on this team and have the moments that Adolis Garcia had, well, then sure. Then we'll do that. We'll come back to us and we'll talk about it.
Hang on, I just want to go back here for a quick second. So you said, so give us a number that you think would be fair, and we'll double that, right?
Yeah,
that was your rationale.
That's my rationale. Yeah. Because
there's two takeaways from that. One, this is why you're not an owner, and two, this is why you're not exactly. A GM.
True.
Listen, I think. There's a number of ways to look at the Garcia situation. And I think that, you know, what played out publicly was that, they're negotiating on this arbitration deal. But I think all along they were really talking about this 2-year deal that was going to give him kind of the longer term security. I think if anything, if you go back and look at the deal compared to Kyle Tucker, Tucker made out a little bit better than Adolis did, because Tucker got $5 million after losing arbitration last year, and he's getting $12 million this year on a 1-year deal. So he's getting $17 million guaranteed. Adolis is only going to get $14.5 million guaranteed. And he took what Tucker took as a loss last year. Look, if Tucker had come in around $6 million last year instead of $7.5 million, he'd have either won his arbitration case or he'd have gotten a settlement in the 5-5, 5-7 area. If Adolis had filed at six and a half, he'd have either gotten a settlement for 1 year at about 5-7, or he'd have won that case. So I think they left a little bit of money on the table, but I think ultimately this was about getting Adolis Garcia some long-term financial security because he is older than most arbitration eligible players, first-year arbitration players. I think he does know that, he plays a very physical brand of baseball, and he is one leap away going the other way than it did last September from basically, you know, that knee exploding. So I think he needed to get some financial security. And I think that if it was going to be a 2-year deal that offered him the opportunity to, with some incentive, well, they're mostly voting escalators, but there are some plate appearance incentives that gave him a chance to earn as much as Tucker, if not more. I think that was going to satisfy him in a way that he would feel secure, but also feel driven to prove, look, I can even do better than this. So I think what I wrote last week, Kevin, was that the thing people remember about negotiations is that they don't remember anything about negotiations. The outcome was basically what these sides needed to get, was a 2-year deal that gives him some security. And I think that's the most important thing. And I do think you're going to see an Adolis Garcia that comes to camp with some peace of mind that, hey, I've taken care of my family long term here.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how he reacts and how he feels about it. I think, you know, like I said, Adolis is an emotional guy, and I'm not saying that he was going to do this or not, but at some point you have to understand that when a guy has risen to the level that Adolis has and he's done what Adolis has done, you never know how that's going to affect him, right? You don't know how he's going to react to that kind of stardom, thinking that, look what I did. And he sits back and look, and these other two guys are making $500 million, and I'm making, you know, chump change compared to them, and yet I'm the cleanup hitter. So that's what you have to worry about, is this going to happen? And that's why I said, you know, you would say to Adolis, what do you think is fair? And he comes at me with a number, and then I go over that number. You know,
the principle of what you offered is completely fair and would be a really progressive look, right? To say we're going to reward you above and beyond what we need to for this season. Certainly, you're not going to give a guy double what he asked for, but I think, you know, if you say, look, you were ALCS MVP last year, and we think that's worth an additional X number of dollars, an additional $2 million in your deal for this year, that's fine. And if you win it again next year, then let's talk about, you know, we'll give you a double that bonus. So I think all of that makes sense. But honestly, you're not going to pay a guy double what his market value should be. As admirable as that may be, if you were an owner, I just don't think that's realistic.
It's not realistic. But Adolis is not realistic. It is not realistic, his career and what's happened with him, right? I mean, he's completely the outlier, and will always be that in Rangers history. I mean, you can't go back too far when people were saying, "Oh, this guy's, yeah, he was just a flash in the pan. He was good for like 3 months, and that was good. And now he's done, and that's over." Well, then Then the next thing you know, he's in the World Series. He's Godzilla out there, you know, in the ALCS. My gosh. I mean, he practically, it was like Samson pulling down the pillars around the, Minute Maid Park. It was just unbelievable what he did to the Astros. So, you know, it is, he's an outlier. And that's why, you know, I've told you this before, and I've said this before. I just have kind of a heartfelt feeling for Adolis. He wears his heart on his sleeve. And he's everything that Corey Seager said about him, you know, and you almost kind of feel like there somebody ought to be looking out for him as much as he's putting into this too. And when you spend the money that the Rangers are spending, what he's making is just nothing compared to that. So anyway, that's my point on all that. All right. So that ought to do it now for the Rangers segment of our podcast. We're going to move over and talk a little bit about the Mavericks. Their new owner showed up on the court, well, set court side anyway, Monday night against the Wizards. So the Mavericks were coming off a spectacular win of Oklahoma City, the first game after the trade deadline, in which they acquired Daniel Gafford, the center, from the Wizards, and as well as PJ Washington, the power forward from Charlotte. They beat Oklahoma City by 35 points. It was just phenomenal, and it made me wonder what in the world is going to happen after that. Well, they went back and almost fell on their faces against the Wizards, had to scramble to put that game away in the fourth quarter. But as I said, we did get a good look at the new owner, Patrick DeMont. He's the son-in-law of the Adelsons, who are all part of that fortune in Las Vegas from the Sands. And he was we met him before the game. He just had a little meet and greet. It lasted about, 2 minutes. He seemed very polite and genuine and sincere and basically everything that Mark Cuban wasn't when Mark Cuban was introduced as the owner. He didn't even want a press conference. We didn't, there was no Q&A, there was no nothing. This may be the last time we ever even talked to Patrick DeMont, for all I can tell. But it is very curious to watch this whole thing develop, because at one point, Mark Cuban did go over and talk to DeMont and Nico, who was sitting between Nico Harrison and Cent Marshall, the CEO. And so that was an interesting dynamic as well. And then Mark went back over to his usual seats over by the baseline and spent the rest of the game there. That's no longer the seat of power with the Mavericks. And I think that has apparently finally set in with Mark, who was telling everybody after the sale was made that, I'll still be the governor of the team. I'll still be making the basketball decisions, to which basically the new ownership has told him kind of behind the scenes, well, no, you're not. We're the ones with the money. We're the ones with the power. And we're the ones who will be making the decisions going forward. So,
Dave, which everyone knew, right?
Well, yeah, this is what happens, right? If you they didn't buy this team to be silent owners. So people from Las Vegas.
Let Mark run it however he wants. Yeah.
Yeah. That was never going to happen. And that's what was so, and I was out there when that happened too, that the day that was announced, and that was the most bizarre set of circumstances, trying to figure out what was actually happening and how this is going to happen and why it happened. And I, frankly, I'm still not sure about all the whys. We've made a lot of guesses and we said a lot of things. But seeing what has happened with the new ownership coming in, and clearly they're going to be in charge, not Mark, it kind of backs me up to, then why did Mark agree to this? It's not like he needed the money. I mean, $2 billion is great. I mean, it would be great for me. If I was getting that, I'd written my last column for the Dallas Morning News. I can tell you that. I'm not holding on to do anything going forward.
Yeah, but $2 billion doesn't go as far as it used to when you're giving everybody double what they asked for, Kevin.
I know, that's true. Well, that's me, though. I go in, when they bring the bill to the table, I say to the waiter or waitress,
you're
how
really
much
good.
Do you want for this meal? I'll double it, okay? There we go. That's me.
But, I thought, one, Brad Townsend did speak to DeMont before he came into town, an outstanding piece that I thought DeMont kind of addressed everything. And what I found the most interesting is it related to Mark Cuban, and he was very politic about it, but he talked about, his experience and wanting his voice and why wouldn't we? And, we've gotten, I like Mark, we've talked on other things, but, all of this. But you really read and digest what he said. And he said, well, I have the seat on the Board of Governors. I have the final call. Nico Harrison is the general manager. Cent Marshall is over business and is outstanding at what she does. He delineated all of the roles except for Cuban's. And Cuban was basically kind of an owner emeritus sort of role, right? That sure, I'm going to seek your input. You know this league better than I do, but seeking your input and turning the decision over to you are two different things. And I thought that piece by Brad Townsend very subtly, it wasn't, wasn't beating Mark over the head or humiliating him publicly, but I thought it very strongly got across that no, that's not how it's going to work going forward. This is how it works. Me, Nico Harrison, Cent Marshall.
Yeah, no question about that. And in that little meet and greet that we had for a few minutes, he made clear how much he liked Brad's story. Yes, and he said not all of the stories that get written about us I like. And then he kind of laughed after he said that. So this will be very interesting to me to see how this develops. I'm guessing that he will turn this over to Nico and Cent Marshall and for the business side, of course, in which Mark probably already kind of has done that. I thought it was also interesting that a young woman that I did not recognize was walking around with Mark. And today I got an email asking if I would be interested in writing a story about this new venture that Mark is starting up. And I thought, boy, this already looks like he's looking for a parachute here. You know, it's like, here's something else I can do. So this is going to be very interesting to see going forward how that's going to work out. As for the trade they made, so far it looks pretty good. Daniel Gafford looks like Wilt Chamberlain on this team at this point. I tell you, his former teammate Kyle Kuzma said after the game Monday night that he's got the easiest job in the world with everybody doubling Luka or Kyrie, mostly Luka, that he can just stand there in the key and be wide open. And he's all he has to do is make the right read. And then from that point, he's going to end up with a double-double every night, which it certainly looks like that. Two games in, he's averaging, I think, almost as many points and rebounds as he is in minutes. So it's been very impressive so far. PJ Washington, they tried to paint that last night against the Wizards as a good performance by him. I don't know. It was 9 points. They weren't pretty points either. I didn't think he was that effective on Kuzma. They put him on him. And he was 9 of 19 from the floor. I didn't see that PJ was much of a hindrance to him, frankly. So we'll see how that works out. But you certainly can't question to me at this point the acquisition of Gafford. One of the things that Jason Kidd talked about before the game was that this affords them the ability to play, 48 minutes with a big lineup if they want to do that, which they couldn't do that before. And as Chuck Cooperstein pointed out to me, we did an interview before the game, this would be the first time probably since they had Tyson Chandler and Brendan Haywood as their two centers on the championship team that they could say that. When you had two guys of that quality been able to play. So this certainly gives them some more versatility when they need that. And I do think this team has improved its playoff chances much, much better. I think they could probably get up to a 6th seed. It's going to be hard for them to get up any higher than that. And if that backcourt is performing at a high level, they're going to be a hard team for a lot of teams to play.
Well, the versatility is the key. They could really only win one way with the team the way it was previously constructed. And it was small ball. They were getting killed on the boards. Defensively, you just couldn't mix and match. In the playoffs, I don't think a lot of people talk about that enough. The ability to mix and match defensively in the playoffs is huge. And they just didn't have that versatility. Maxi Kleber at one time gave them some of that, but at this stage of his career, I'm not sure how much he does that now. So, yeah, these are two, they should fit in seamlessly and really help them on their playoff push. And when you have two players in Doncic and Kyrie Irving who can take over a game or a series, you at least give yourselves a shot in just about any series you would have. It's going to be very difficult for them to get back to the Western Conference Finals the way they did a couple of years ago. But this is an interesting team that I think you're a little more intrigued by what they can do this postseason than they were before these moves were made.
Yeah, it's also those guys were the players they added were seasoned, but they were also young guys too. These guys are 25 in that range there, same age as Luka. So you have to like the possibilities and the potential of this anyway. I don't know how much you're going to get. The formula in the NBA no longer is you have to have three superstars and you fill in around them. Now it's two superstars and you fill in around that. And that's kind of what you were limited to. And I think that these guys, certainly Gafford is making a huge difference already, a huge fan favorite. He blocked five shots last night. You know, he had 14 rebounds in the first half, six yeah. offensive rebounds in the first half. I mean, when's the last time any Mavericks player had six offensive rebounds in a game? You know, he's just really giving them a different dynamic. So I'll be interested to see how this develops going forward. And at least it's interesting because I got to tell you, David, watching some of those games when they just come down there just slogging down the floor and Luka's just pounding, trying to make something happen here, that's got to be brutal after a while.
Yeah, and that is something that you always have to be careful of with not only a dominant player, but a player who needs to dominate the ball to be dominant. Sometimes it lessens the energy, especially on the offensive end, and just that erosion. And again, asking guys to expend everything defensively and then run down on the other end of the court and rest on offense is not really a great incentive for a lot of guys either, you know. And at this league, you have to be able to score. You have to be able to spread the court. You know, the only drawback to a player like that sometimes is that his teammates may not be as fully invested as they need to be in a team sport to advance. You saw that some with Allen Iverson in Philadelphia. I mean, you've seen it time and time again throughout the league. And so it's about finding the right personalities and the right fit of basketball skills to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I think that's where the Mavericks are right now. And so, you know, as I've said, the first game was just out of sight. The second game was brutal for about 3.5 quarters until they finally started to put something together and put the Wizards away. And we'll see what they do Wednesday before the break here. But I think they put themselves in a good position. That is three deadlines for Nico Harrison. And I would say right now, just judging on what we've seen in a very small sample size, obviously, but he's 3 for 3. We can argue about the addition of Kyrie Irving and how much that really improved the team. But they acquired talent and difference-making talent in all three of his deadline deals. Now, you can certainly question what he did over summers and how they went into seasons with the personnel that he acquired. But at the deadline, I think these have been impact deals. And we'll see what happens going forward. All right, Evan's yawning, so I guess that means that we're done.
I just want to be clear. I'm not tired. I'm just bored of you.
Well, okay, sure. That's fine. That's fair. Anyway... I'm going to have Evan eliminated from this podcast for next week. So just be me and David for all you people wondering. All right, that's going to do it for our podcast this week. We'll come back next week and see what's going on then and see if Rex Ryan has asserted himself again into the Cowboys situation. Maybe he's going for head coach next time. We'll see. But from everybody in here to everybody out there, thanks, and we'll see you next time.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.